Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. Sublette County has been in the news a lot because of its air quality problems, which largely stem from natural gas production. But there's another issue, too. Pollutants have been showing up in water wells. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
The pollutants in question are petroleum products like diesel range organics and benzene. They first started showing up in water wells in the Pinedale Anticline gas field in 2006. That prompted the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of Environmental Quality to call for extensive testing. And the following year, they detected hydrocarbons in 85 wells. Several were at concentrations exceeding the DEQ's limit for what's safe to drink. Since then, there have been dozens of detections each year, and each year, a handful exceed the legal limit. But nobody knows where the pollutants are coming from. Mary Gamper is a scientist with the BLM. She says her agency is working with DEQ to try to find answers, but that's hard to do because no testing was done before gas development started.
It's very difficult for us to come in after the fact and say it's this or it's this or it's this. We did a lot of investigative chemistry. There's a lot of geochemistry, a lot of analysis involved. It does become a little bit of forensic science.
Gamper says the hydrocarbons could have come from drilling mud or from water or condensate that comes up when you extract natural gas or from any number of other sources. And the sources could be different for each well. Until there are answers, DEQ is trying to make sure the pollution gets cleaned up. Jules Feck is a project manager for DEQ's Voluntary Remediation Program, or VRP. She says if a well shows hydrocarbons over the legal limit, they talk with the company that owns the well.
We say to them that they can either join the VRP voluntarily or clean up the contamination under an administrative order. That's where we say, well, you need to clean this up because we have a non-degradation policy for groundwater in our state, and we have cleanup standards that must be met.
Feck says companies have been very cooperative about joining the voluntary remediation program.
I have issued 5 liability assurances where they have cleaned up to our standards.
But in other wells, the contamination has not gone away. Feck says that means there's an ongoing source of pollution. The BLM and the DEQ both emphasize that most of the hydrocarbon detections have been in industrial wells, not drinking water wells, and most detections have been very low, under the legal limit. But some say that's not reassuring enough. Craig Thompson is a professor of engineering and earth science at Western Wyoming Community College, and he used to run the water quality lab there. He says Sublette County residents who get their drinking water from wells should be worried.
I'm bothered when someone passes off a groundwater source as, well, this is just an industrial well, and this level of pollutant is below the action level. What they don't say in either one of those is, this is pollution, and it could be a real problem. And we don't know what's going on. We don't know where it's coming from, and we don't know where it's going.
According to the BLM, industrial wells, stock wells, and domestic wells are all tapped into the same aquifer. The domestic wells are much shallower than the industrial wells, but Thompson says that doesn't necessarily mean they're safe.
Benzene is a serious, serious pollutant. This is a carcinogenic compound, causes cancer. My concern is simply that none of these pollutant levels should be in any of this groundwater, whether they're using it for industrial purposes, for domestic purposes, or for stock watering.
Area activist Linda Baker with the Upper Green River Alliance has additional concerns. She points out that groundwater and surface water are connected in the area.
We are at the headwaters of the Colorado River, and what we do to our water here affects 7 million downstream users. So we have a responsibility to keep that water clean and to send it downstream clean.
So far, there's been no evidence that surface water has been affected. Still, Baker is concerned that regulatory agencies are not taking the issue seriously enough. She's frustrated that after 6 years of detections, DEQ and BLM still have no answers about the source of the contaminants. And she's upset that some wells haven't been cleaned up yet. But Deborah Harris, who deals with groundwater pollution control for DEQ, says to be patient.
We do take this very seriously. Just the fact that it has taken a long time does not mean that the agencies are not taking it seriously.
DEQ and BLM have drilled special monitoring wells to help them determine the extent to which the aquifers are affected. They've been doing more rigorous hydrologic mapping to figure out how groundwater moves through the region, and they expect to complete their low-level hydrocarbon report, which will specify the sources of the contaminants, in June. Once that's out, the BLM says they'll consider adopting new policies to prevent future pollution. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
You can find links to water monitoring data, as well as a map showing the locations of gas wells and water wells on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
State agencies worked hard to trim the fat in order to meet an average of 6% budget cuts the Wyoming legislature put into effect this year. The judicial branch took a hit of 4% budget cuts. Because the state revenue forecast is still cloudy, further cuts may be considered. As the state population grows, so does the need for the court system, which makes it next to impossible to cut back. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reports.
Judge Wesley Roberts returned to his office after a long weekend to find a mountain of color-coded files sitting on his desk.
Most of the days, I kind of forced myself not to leave my court until everything is off of this desk. The things that the clerks need to process, because if I don't get these things done, they can't move the cases forward on their desk. So this is a pretty common occurrence.
The Riverton Court is enormously busy. It shares with a circuit court in Lander the workload of adjudicating Fremont County's traffic violations, domestic disputes, and civil suits under $50,000. Riverton has the busier of the two dockets, and the number of cases on it is growing.
Where we were 5,700 for fiscal year 2011, fiscal year 2012 is probably in the neighborhood of pushing 8,000, high sevens.
Unlike district courts, which handle bigger, more serious cases, circuit courts are managed by the Wyoming Supreme Court staff. When the state legislature met this winter, lawmakers were talking about across-the-board budget cuts. Chief Justice Marilyn Kite assured them that the judicial branch understands the need for fiscal conservatism and has streamlined its operations by digitizing records, allowing citations to be paid online, and limiting printing of law publications. Kite says the branch can't afford to cut personnel.
There's only so many working hours that a judge can operate and can respond to the filings in his court. So when we get behind, it really impacts the people more than it impacts the judges, and we can't get our work done as quickly as we need to, and we have important matters and people need to get on with their lives.
The Supreme Court has some solid data to back up claims that it's working as efficiently as possible. Here's Deputy Court Administrator Rhonda Munger.
We know that we are running a tight ship. We do not have excess employees anywhere.
Since the 1990s, the Wyoming Supreme Court has been conducting weighted workload studies. For 2 months, all the judges, court magistrates, and court commissioners keep track of everything they do and how long it takes to do it, down to the minute. It standardizes the work a judge does and shows the work distribution around the state. For example, the three circuit court judges in Natrona County, which is known as District 7, are doing the work of 3.61 judges, while two judges and two magistrates in District 8 handle the counties of Converse, Goshen, Niobrara, and Platte. They share the work of 1.78 judges. Obviously, that district spans several counties, so it can take more people to cover a smaller workload.
It's a way for us to go with a definitive measure to the legislature. Instead of just saying, we need more people, we need more people, this gives us hard data, and the legislature really relies on these studies.
According to the 2012 report, Judge Wesley Roberts at the Riverton Circuit Court is doing the work of 1.3 judges. By contrast, Lander Circuit Court Judge Robert Denhart, who handles cases across an invisible jurisdictional line and in the Du Bois Satellite Court, has a workload of 0.75. Also, the Riverton Court was understaffed for a year in the number of clerks it needed to do its job. The Wyoming Supreme Court has used past workload study data to move a vacant clerk position from Teton County to the Riverton office. Judge Denhart now comes up from Lander to Riverton when needed to help with Judge Roberts' caseload. Roberts says this is a good allocation of resources, but they still don't have everything they need.
Now we have to deal with the fact that we have limited courtroom space. You've seen our very tiny building with by far the busiest docket. And safety and security concerns that we have to sort of just live with on a daily basis.
Not only is the Riverton Circuit Court busy, but it also looks bad. Counties are responsible to provide circuit court facilities, and Fremont County gave Riverton a small prefab building with thin walls. Last summer, someone shot a bullet from outside into the courtroom. As a security measure, Riverton stationed large metal industrial storage containers around the building, which hide it almost completely, but it's an imperfect system. Fremont County commissioners have requested funding for a new circuit court building from the State Land and Investments Board. They hope to have good news in June.
Sort of a gray or a dark cloud over the whole process, because you know that you're working in a vulnerable, dangerous facility every single day.
But Roberts is still worried about talk of further state budget cuts and the effects they'll have on his office, which is now back to what he says is a manageable workload. The Wyoming Supreme Court says there's nothing left to cut in the circuit court system but personnel, which will keep courts from serving the public efficiently. Chief Justice Marilyn Kite argues that the judicial branch operates on 2% of the state budget, so if Wyoming's looking for savings, she says, they won't find them there. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
When we come back, we'll hear about the Cheyenne International Film Festival and a new website about Wyoming history. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. Next week, the Cheyenne International Film Festival gets underway. The event begins May 16th and runs through the 19th. The producer of the event is Alan O'Hashi, who's been active in helping Wyoming movie makers, and this venue gives them a chance to showcase their work. But as the title suggests, international films will also be shown. O'Hashi says the event was started 5 years ago and continues to grow. He says they'll be showing a wide range of films.
We have 24 films ranging from 5 minutes to feature-length films. And we have a variety of films, a filmmaker from Iran, kind of had to smuggle their movie out. We have films from the United Kingdom and Canada and Spain, France, from a variety of places, as well as in Wyoming. We have a Wyoming showcase that's happening on opening night, and that's May 16th. And that screening is free. There's a big community reception that's happening at the Paramount Cafe. And the feature film that night, the opening night film, is The Stagecoach and American Crossroads by Jennifer Tenneken, who is a producer up in Jackson. And we'll be showing the winner of the Wyoming Short Film Contest. That film, I don't think the winner's been announced, but they win $25,000 to make a movie in Wyoming. And a couple of the shootout films will be playing that night as well.
You have an HBO film you're going to be showing that with?
Yes. We've been promoting a film that we've been working with the producers as well as HBO to screen around the entire state of Wyoming. It's called American Winter. And people have an opportunity to see it on the small screen in their homes, but we're giving folks an opportunity to see this movie on the big screen during the film festival, and that's on Friday night, the 17th. And that's a film that's sort of a part of our call to action program, in which we link up with community-based nonprofits. In this case, it's the Wyoming Children's Action Alliance, which is an advocacy organization for youth around Wyoming. To show this film really about the plight of families in a tight economy. And it showcases 8 families in the Portland, Oregon area and the trials and tribulations that they had to go through to pull themselves back up and try to get caught in the safety net, which in many cases really had big, huge holes in it. So that's one that we're promoting. And also that's one that we're promoting as part of the Whistle Stop Film Festival, which is content that we gather in from the Cheyenne Festival, as well as just other solicitations, and show them around Wyoming. And we've linked up with many of the community colleges, the Southwest Wyoming United Way organization. We're planning a number of screenings around Wyoming over the course of the year, including at the University of Wyoming and when school starts with the University of Wyoming Social Work Students Organization. So we're trying to just provide content into places that don't normally have opportunities to see independent movies, let alone any kind of movies other than what they might see on their television. So we're looking for local producers in communities around Wyoming that are interested in getting a film festival in a box. We have a whole catalog of movies available in addition to American Winter.
What's been your motivation for this?
Well, it's the main motivation really is storytelling, and the idea is to get communities and individuals within communities to talk about the stories of their communities and to do that within the safe space of the arts, and then in this case, digital media or movies. And so programs like the Call to Actions that we have another one along with a group that benefits United States service veterans that will be screening on Saturday morning, and that gives them an opportunity maybe to reach out to people who may not know about them or may not even be aware of veterans' issues and provide a forum for people to discuss those in really kind of a safe environment.
Alan Ohashi visiting with us again, talking about the Cheyenne International Film Festival, which gets underway next weekend. One of the things that also you're doing this time, I understand it, is you're not only showing films, but you're having some entertainment.
Right. We're kind of taking a page out of the South by Southwest page playbook, which is a big festival down in Austin, Texas. And we're kind of mixing up movies and live entertainment as well. On Saturday night, we're showing a movie called Loaded, which is about a magician who has a bad night, and another film about a misdirection with – it's kind of a crime drama. So we're showing those two films, and then we're coupling that with an evening of magic and entertainment. There's a local illusionist named Dan Jasperson in Cheyenne, and anyone who has seen Dan is mesmerized by his abilities, and we're having a whole show with him on Saturday night. And on Sunday, we have a movie that's about banjos and the movies. It features Jalon Crossland, who's a banjo player, a songwriter, singer out of Ten Sleep. And so we're showcasing that. And then after that, there's a local bluegrass band from Cheyenne called Beatgrass. And Beatgrass will be performing through the evening as well.
People want to get more information about this. Where do they go?
They can go to our website, which is www.CheyenneInternationalFilmFestival.com. And that has ticket information and other information. And they can also dial 307-509-0182. And we can give them information over the telephone as well.
Have you been surprised how well this has gone? I mean, it's really taken off.
Well, you know, the Jackson is one of the seats of film around Wyoming. And, you know, that's really great. And we're just trying to get some cross-pollination in southeast Wyoming. And we're finding that there's interest all over.
And the Cheyenne International Film Festival, one more time, the website if folks want to check it out.
www.CheyenneInternationalFilmFestival.com.
Alan Ohashi, always nice having you on the program, and thank you.
It's always a pleasure, Bob.
Former newspaper reporter and author Tom Ray has a new venture. He is the editor of what's called wyohistory.org. It is a history website about Wyoming. He says the idea for the website came as he was doing a job for the Natrona County School District.
They hired me to write a number of articles on Wyoming history for a history teacher training program, and I thought we need to get these out to more people. So that was kind of the kernel of the idea, but I approached the State Historical Society, it's 3 years ago now this spring, with a kind of a rough idea of a state history website, and they immediately threw their support behind it. They've been wonderful about this the whole time. And so wyohistory.org is a project, an ongoing project of the Wyoming State Historical Society, celebrating its 60th anniversary this year. And that's how it works.
It's a very involved site. Do you want to go through what's on this? Because you've got essays, oral histories. I'll just let you talk about that for a minute.
That's right. We've got the core of the content is articles on Wyoming history. The great majority of these are new articles written by writers around Wyoming that we pay to write the articles. Others of the content is re-edited and culled from other sources on the internet with permission. And so we now have about 300 different items on there, which includes both articles. And then we also have connected with every article are field trip suggestions with little maps and directions on how you can go to sites, to places related to the content in the article. And then we also, and then all the articles also have historic photos in them and one now and again a little video and are sourced. so that there's a real bibliography so you can learn where to find out more information on the subject.
How long did it take to get these articles and get at least what you have right now put together?
We've been working on it for, 3 years this spring. It's been pretty quietly online for since May of 2011. But we didn't want to do a whole lot of publicity until we felt confident that we really did have a useful critical mass of content on there so that once people went there, they might find what they're looking for, and they'll keep coming back. So this isn't something we're just going to put a lot of content up there and then walk away from it. This will keep growing indefinitely. That's which is how to keep it healthy and interesting.
Tom Ray visiting with us again. We're talking about wyohistory.org, the Wyoming history website. I don't run into many places in this country where people know their history as much as maybe some Wyoming natives do.
Yeah.
What's been the feedback so far?
Oh, people seem to like it. And, I tell you, as the site gets broader, better known, one of the really fun things about this job are the emails that I get actually from around the world as well as around Wyoming and the nation. So I got an email from a man in Wales whose great-great uncle preached the gospel in Bighorn, Wyoming in 1884, and he had some letters from his uncle back home to Wales. Would we like to see scans of them? So I said, you bet. So I put him in touch with with Judy Slack at the Wyoming room at the Sheridan County Library, and he sent those letters to her, and those will be part of her collection. Things like that happen not infrequently, and that's one of the most fun parts of this job. Other people, I get emails from people around Wyoming saying, did you know about this, or I've got these papers, or what should I do with this, or what do you know? And so I really feel like we're connecting people's history interests to Wyoming all the time, as well as putting up new content.
Imagine the schools have got to love this.
Every fourth grader in Wyoming studies the Oregon Trail, and we're now working on a big education package of extra activities for kids, lesson plans for teachers, videos of kids visiting the sites on field trips for each of our articles on the Oregon Trail sites. We should be pretty much done with that later this spring, and that'll be then a model for connecting other groups of sites with extras for classroom use, Indian War sites or Range Wars sites or early industrial sites, stuff like that.
It's a great site, wyohistory.org. Tom Ray is the editor, and you can check it out online right now. Tom, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Bob. Thanks for your interest.
When we come back, we'll hear about how the immigration debate might be delayed by talks of amnesty. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. If you're looking for big, stately elk antlers to hang on your wall, the National Elk Refuge in Jackson would be a great place to find them. Except the public isn't allowed into the elk habitat. Instead, the refuge and the Jackson Boy Scouts are gathering and bundling antlers to sell at the annual elk antler auction in Jackson next weekend. It's to benefit elk habitat projects. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez spoke with Lori Iverson of the refuge about it. Iverson says she understands why people want elk antlers, but protecting the wildlife is her first priority.
On the National Elk Refuge, we have much more restricted use. We don't allow people to just go out for a hike out into areas because our main mission is habitat protection and conservation. Because of where we're located, where millions of visitors come through, it would be a problem if we allowed a lot of access onto the refuge. It would be difficult to protect and conserve the habitat here.
Elk shed their antlers every spring. Who's allowed to harvest them where?
Well, the National Elk Refuge staff begins collecting antlers as soon as they start dropping or shedding in early March. Not only to reduce the incidence of illegal poaching, but it helps avoid damage to equipment that could occur if the antlers are accidentally run over during refuge management operations, like supplemental feeding in the winter or spring projects like harrowing and irrigating. The antlers can blend in with snow, and they can also be really difficult to see in dried grass. So we start picking them up as soon as they drop. And then through an annual special use permit, the Jackson District Boy Scouts are allowed to help refuge staff pick up antlers one Saturday each year. They help us make a final sweep for antlers to sell at the annual auction. And so antlers are not sold individually. They're sold in bundles. And this is all done through assistance with the Jackson District Scout leaders. So after the antlers are sorted, bundled, weighed, labeled, they're stored on pallets and trailers to be transported over to Jackson's Town Square on the morning of the antler auction. The auction itself begins at 10.
Who comes to this auction to bid, and what are they usually looking for?
I think a lot of them are artists. They are looking at commercial use to make chandeliers, to make chairs or lamps, use them as knife handles, use them as drawer pulls, use them for jewelry. That seems to be the majority of people that come to the auction. I know in the past few years, the Boy Scouts have made some smaller bundles for just the average citizen that just wants a few nice ones to have around a ranch or a home for decorative purpose or to tack up on their garage.
And how many antlers, as far as poundage or numbers, end up going on auction, and how much do they sell for?
The 10-year average is about 8,300 pounds. Last year, we were a little short. We had some mild conditions and lower snow totals on the refuge, so that affected the number of antlers that we could collect and make available for sale. Sometimes the elk leave the refuge before they've dropped their antlers. That's where neighboring areas like the Bridger-Teton National Forest come into play, because people know that elk were wintering in other areas or perhaps left the refuge when they shed their antlers.
So 8,300 pounds usually each year. How much do they cost?
It can vary from year to year, and I'm not really sure what the cause is for the fluctuation from one year to another. The 10-year average is about $9.30 per pound. Last year, we had an average of $12.15 per pound.
So I understand that the proceeds from the auction go to benefit the elk. Can you tell me what that means, like what kind of projects it goes to fund?
Yeah, previously 80% of the proceeds of the antler auction have been donated back to the National Elk Refuge. Through a revised agreement with the Scouts, we'll now be retaining 75%, and they'll receive 25% for all the work that they do. But that funding is absolutely critical for the National Elk Refuge. It's used for habitat projects on the refuge, like seeding, irrigating, and purchasing necessary equipment to carry out the work. The funds also pay for seasonal labor staff required of the refuge's extensive irrigation program.
I know that there'd been discussions about whether to continue the elk feeding program. Have there been any changes to how that's been approached in the last year or two or moving forward?
That is our ultimate goal, is to reduce the reliance on supplemental feeding here on the National Elk Refuge. We've made changes to our hunt programs, trying to reduce the number of elk so that we can lower our number of elk wintering here on the refuge. And we are developing an adaptive management plan to look at previous efforts, look at the success, and have a plan for what to do next to get us in line with the goals of the 2007 Bison and Elk Management Plan.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, you bet.
Lori Iverson works with the National Elk Refuge in Jackson.
Jackson Hole's Elk Fest runs May 18th and 19th. The Jackson District Boy Scouts of America annual elk antler auction begins Saturday at 10 a.m. Antlers inspection begins at 7.
A U.S. Senate committee has introduced an immigration reform plan that includes a path to citizenship for immigrants living illegally in the U.S. Opponents claim that such a path rewards people who have broken the law by giving them amnesty. Under current law, many immigrants seeking residency have to leave the country, sometimes for 10 years or more. But this deportation often has side effects. Wyoming Public Radio's Luke Hammonds has more.
At a farm off of Highway 20, south of Worland, sits an orange trailer. A few children's bikes lie on the ground. Behind the trailer, despite a dusting of spring snow, the fields are ready for barley to be planted. The family who lives in the trailer, Veronica and Fernando Aguayo, and their three daughters, recently went through an extremely difficult period when Fernando, the main wage earner of the family, was forced to return to Mexico in his effort to become a U.S. resident. Fernando married Veronica, a U.S. resident in Mexico, in 2004. After Veronica became pregnant, she returned to her hometown of Worland. A few months later, Fernando crossed the border without a visa to join her in Wyoming.
I want to come to USA because, you know, you see the news on the TV and Mexico is just a dangerous place to live. And I really don't want to raise my family in one place like that.
Their child was born, and they were married in Wyoming. With the use of a fabricated name and social security number, Fernando found work on local farms. Life was good for the family for a few years. Fernando learned to irrigate and got a better job on another farm. He and Veronica had another daughter. They weren't rich, but they weren't in debt and had enough to buy a truck, as well as gifts for their children. But Fernando was frightened of being deported and sent away from his family, so he began the process of becoming a legal resident. After months of filing paperwork, Fernando's lawyer told him he had to go to the U.S. consulate in Juarez, Mexico, to get his resident visa issued. After he arrived in Juarez, immigration officials told him he had to wait 1 year for his case to be heard, and even then he still might not be allowed to enter the U.S. for 10 years. Immigration lawyer David Kolku says that when Fernando left the country to receive his visa, he triggered another law called unlawful presence. Unlawful presence means that Fernando broke the law when he crossed the border in 2004 without a visa. His punishment is being barred from re-entry into the U.S. for 10 years. But Kolko says he could get this punishment waived by proving his family of U.S. citizens would suffer extreme hardships in his absence.
Frequently, the family is relying upon the foreign national's income or assets in order to support the family unit.
Kolko says that removing the main wage earner can put a family on welfare. He adds that the family suffers because suddenly a home with two parents only has one. Other hardships might include Fernando's daughters receiving inferior educations if the family is forced to live in Mexico. After Fernando left, Veronica and the girls were asked to leave the house that had been provided by Fernando's employer. Even working 16-hour days, Veronica's job as a nurse's assistant did not cover her debts. Soon the family found themselves in low-income housing, selling everything they could to pay the bills.
I sold our dining room table. I sold our couches. We were eating on the floor. So at the low-income housing, all we had was our beds, our clothes, and that's it.
The family fell deep into debt. Fernando began to send money from Mexico to the U.S., but it wasn't enough. Veronica said on top of the fees she and Fernando paid to immigration services, she had to pay
medical bills, lawyers, and people who lent us money, my parents. I mean, I was in collections. I could not pay our truck payment. I couldn't do anything.
Eventually, the emotional and economic strain of being away from her husband became too much. Veronica moved with her daughters to Mexico. She left the U.S. with some serious questions.
If my husband was working and I was working and we were doing great, why would they throw him out? I wouldn't have needed the assistance if they hadn't done that.
Former Wyoming U.S. Senator Alan Simpson is knowledgeable about the subject. He worked a controversial immigration reform measure nearly 20 years ago. He says one of the challenges to passing the bill was figuring out what to do with people like Fernando.
The word amnesty is just gets everybody all worked into a frenzy. These people are here illegally, by God, and we're not going to give them a break. They came here, they're like a burglar, snuck into our house and stole from us, and they just rape and pillage and steal. You know, that's the pitch.
But is the current political climate similar to that of Simpson's tenure, or even 2007, when President Bush failed to pass immigration reform? Co-director of the Center for International Human Rights Law and Advocacy, Noah Novogradsky, says the word amnesty is used less and less, and that it is inappropriate to describe the new laws proposed by the Gang of Eight.
Amnesty suggests to me that you're giving people a free pass for past illegal conduct. That is not what the proposed legislation will do.
Novogradsky says the proposed legislation will fine those living here illegally, as well as create a significant waiting period for them to become residents. He adds that most economists say that with few exceptions, illegal immigrants have been good for the U.S. economically.
Think about it this way. They are paying into Social Security and they're not taking out from it. Many economists have put a price tag on that, and it is billions of dollars of benefit to the economy.
Meanwhile, after waiting a year in Mexico, Fernando qualified for his resident visa. He now has a farm job like the one he had before. He says things are more difficult now because of the bills that mounted while he was out of the country, but he's glad to be back with his family and remains positive that they will soon pay off their debtors. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Luke Hammonds.
Oliver Walter came to the University of Wyoming in 1970 to teach political science and became dean of the College of Arts and Sciences in 1989. This summer, he'll be retiring. I sat down with him to talk about his tenure at UW and the future for both the school and himself. He started out talking about some changes he witnessed in his decades as dean.
When I came here
We really didn't have a systematic way to evaluate teaching, and there was not nearly as much emphasis on research. And finally, I don't think there was as much emphasis on diversity. That has vastly changed since I've been here.
Were those all conscious efforts by the university to move in those directions, or were they more organic changes?
No, they are. Virtually all of them were attempts to change. For instance, on teaching evaluations now, all the students in arts and sciences are asked to, by the web, fill out an evaluation of every class every semester. We've never had that before. Certainly with research, it's been that way. Every department now has research expectations, and there's simply a lot higher bar to get tenure than when I came. I maybe don't want to say that, but we simply expect a lot more, and faculty know that we expect a lot more.
What about learning? How has that changed in the student body itself?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to say that cell phones... in my class, I'm teaching this semester, if I ask a question, somebody will pull out their smartphone and type it in and get the answer. Really, the electronic getting on the web and getting answers, and whether it's Wikipedia or some other source, that's been a major change that I never seen in the past. And, of course, the use of computers. We didn't have... desktop computers or portable computers at all.
So where do you see higher education heading now, both in Wyoming and maybe on a larger scale?
Yeah, a lot of controversy about that because higher education is expensive. You know, you get what you pay for. And American higher education is viewed the best in the world. That's why we have so many international students coming to the United States. Even at the University of Wyoming, we have 800 international students, and we're increasing all the time. And they come here because they view it as the best possible education. But it is expensive. Now, at the University of Wyoming, of course, given our tuition plus the Hathaway and so on, we're far below just about every other school. So back to your question, right now the argument is that we should have a lot more online courses, and I think online education is fine in some respects. It's always going to be second best. It is best to have a teacher in front of a relatively small class. We can't afford that in every circumstance, but that's still best, and it's going to be best forever, even though it may cost a lot more. So the future is going to be kind of a mix.
So how do you keep that balance between having enough of that and not totally destroying that person-to-person relationship?
Well, I mean, first of all, universities do have to pay a lot of attention to their costs. But just as important, the long-range trend here in the last 20 years is that the amount of state funding that goes to higher public universities has been decreasing. A number of states, the amount they spend on prisons is more than they spend on higher education. And, you know, if you want quality, you've got to pay for it, and there's no easy way out. It can mean more taxes. If you want quality, you got to pay for it.
And at UW specifically, you recently talked about morale being kind of down. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I've been here since 1970, and all that time, and it has been through one big boom and bust cycle in the late 70s, and that's when everything was going well, and then in the early 80s, the economy went into the tank, and appropriations didn't rise appreciably for about 20 years, but all those times, I can only remember 2 years when we didn't get some kind of salary increase. And now we've had four when the economy is not really bad. And Wyoming has about as big a surplus as per capita as any place in the country. We give out our salaries on the basis of merit. And basically what we've been saying to faculty is, especially those who are untenured, okay, you've been working hard and teaching well and doing your research, and, hey, we're not going to reward you. We're not going to give any merit. And as other universities and other states, the economy is improving, we'll start seeing a diminution of those young, productive faculty. It's already starting this year. And that is not a good thing. Universities are composed of great students and great faculty, and, you know, we have done pretty well on students, but you got to pay attention to the faculty, too. I have no axe to grind here. I'm retiring, but I can tell you it's not that faculty expect that they're going to earn as much as medical doctors and things like that, but you've got to have at least some kind of incentive year after year to build loyalty to the institution.
So what have been some of the highlights in your career at UW?
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've really enjoyed is the increase in our international students and our increase in interaction with universities. For me, it was particularly in China, bringing those students over here and sending our students over there and visiting them and bringing their faculty over here. I mean, I think that's a real improvement in the liberal arts education. We have increased study abroad for our students in arts and sciences. About 1 out of 4 ANS students before they graduate have had some kind of international experience. And I have found that is just a wonderful confidence-building, perspective-expanding kind of experience for our students. So that has really been, to me, a major plus in what we do.
So what are you going to do now that you're retiring?
I've been dean for 24 years, and when you're dean of arts and sciences, you have 29 departments and programs, and it's a full-time job. And so I've been scheduled for 24 years. And I take vacations, of course, but I'm always thinking about the schedule when I get back. So the first thing I'm going to do is not have a schedule for a number of months. We have kids who live in various parts of the country and one that lives in Oman now, and I want to go visit them. After that, I think I'd like to come back and maybe teach a course or two or teach a course in China and so on.
That was Oliver Walter, the dean of UW's College of Arts and Sciences, who's retiring in July. When we come back, we'll have the latest installment in our series about young entrepreneurs in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Back.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. This weekend, a new set of graduates are leaving the University of Wyoming. For some, they're facing an unknown job situation, but others are ready to jump into their careers. The graduates also talked about Wyoming's efforts to keep them in state. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck sat down with 3 graduates from UW's College of Business and found that 2 are leaving and 1 thinks he'll hang around a bit longer.
If you've not been to the University of Wyoming in a while, then you've not had a chance to see the state-of-the-art College of Business. The structure features high-tech amenities in classrooms, a mini TV studio in the basement, and a beautiful commons area in the middle of the facility. That's where we meet graduating seniors Libby Stetson from Craig, Colorado, and Derek Jarrett from Gillette. Stetson is an accounting major, which means it was not hard for her to find work.
The placement is almost 100%. And so every year there's a big recruiting event that happens here, and a lot of firms come. And there's usually way more jobs available for us as accountants than there are accountants to fill the jobs. And so we're lucky and fortunate in that regard.
She says she's heading to be an accountant at a firm in Fort Worth, Texas. Jared studied business administration and thought he was going to get a job with a coal company in his hometown of Gillette. But coal is facing tough times these days, and so he's going to try and make himself more marketable.
I think I'm going to be coming back to get my MBA here at the University of Wyoming. I built a pretty good relationship with the dean and also with the MBA director. So I think I'm going to do that unless there's some great job offer or opportunity that opens itself up before then that I can't really pass up.
Jared knows one thing. He wants to work in Wyoming. In past years, business students indicated that there was little they could do in the state and were very interested in leaving. But Jared says that has changed. He says a number of his friends agree with him.
We all kind of love Wyoming just because it's kind of our own little thing. And when we go traveling in groups, especially with like the school, people are like, whoa, where are you guys from? Wyoming. Well, where's that? And then we get to show them, like, this is what Wyoming is. And I'd rather do that and kind of be an advocate for Wyoming almost than go somewhere else and live there.
While Stetson is leaving the state, she almost took a position in Casper. But she says many of her friends are thinking of staying.
business communities seem to be getting stronger, I think, and that Wyoming has taken a lot of steps in trying to find jobs and to make jobs available. And I know the university is playing a big part in that. They're really pushing for people to stay in Wyoming and are showing all of the students that are not from Wyoming, like, why you should love it or why you could love it. And I think that it's starting to change people's minds a little bit.
Another student is Casey Watson from Douglas. When we spoke to him, he was on his way to Oregon for a couple of job interviews. His family recently relocated there. Watson majors in business administration and has three job offers on the table in the banking industry. One of those offers is in his hometown of Douglas, and he has not ruled out returning. But no matter where he goes, Watson is excited.
I think I've been prepared well for what to expect and what will be expected of me. Got the best education background, and I know I'm prepared to enter at full speed.
Watson credits the UW College of Business for making him so marketable. He says the curriculum forces you to learn about all aspects of the business world, and he adds that the faculty was amazing, a sentiment shared by Derek Jarrett.
They're able to not only show you what to do, but to show you how to do it and show you what you're learning in class is going to actually be applicable down the road.
For Libby Stetson, she will always carry the University of Wyoming with her.
I've gotten an incredible foundation in my education, but I've also learned more from them than just that. You know, I've learned about the kind of person I want to be and what kind of a life I want to live and what kind of an example I want to make. And so I think that, I don't know, it's just kind of set me on the right path, and I'll always be thankful for the university.
And when asked what he didn't like about his time at UW, Casey Watson responded,
"That's a tough question. I don't know if I do have a bad experience."
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Alternative medicine and the vast red desert of southwestern Wyoming are not often thought of as synonymous. The endless miles of sagebrush and open range lend themselves to an idea of a rougher existence. Not the sort of place where you might expect to find a good cup of organic herbal tea. But in our occasional series on Upstarts, one woman believes the area has a growing interest in natural health remedies, and she's out to prove it. Wyoming Public Radio's Amanda LeClaire has more.
Heidi Harvey opens the doors to her shop every morning at 10. She dusts off the counters, restocks the jars of herbal supplements, and brews a thermos full of organic tea. Harvey is the owner and sole employee of Wild Roots, the only holistic healthcare store in Rock Springs.
Over here. A few books here that are really great, high blood pressure and cholesterol.
Contrary to what you may think about the city's reputation as a hardworking blue-collar area, natural healing therapies are a growing business here. Harvey opened Wild Roots last year and has not only seen a steady increase in her business, but also for the handful of holistic therapists who rent space in her store. Alternative medicine wasn't always a passion of Harvey's, though. As a young mom in Wyoming, she adhered to the usual mix of over-the-counter medications during times when her family was ill. That is, until the day she realized that the benefits weren't really worth the potential health risk.
Tylenol had just recently been recalled, and I had been giving them that with teething and fever issues. And a good friend of mine introduced essential oils to me, and they worked so fast, and I was just amazed. And they were healthy, no side effects, just positive.
Harvey was so impressed with the effects of using natural herbal oils to combat the colds, fevers, and allergies her family suffered from that she and her partner felt the need to share this newfound knowledge with friends and neighbors. They started holding classes in essential oil therapy at the local library, but within a few years, the need for a physical retail space became apparent.
And then we decided we need to share it a little bit more, you know, further with more product and besides the oils. It is a lifestyle change. That was when Wild Roots, the idea of it, was born.
Since opening last summer, Harvey says she's seen a surprising diversity in the customers walking through her door. From seniors looking for a new approach to problems like high cholesterol and heart disease, to moms with young children who want to stop relying on traditional cold and flu meds. Lately, she's been visited by workers from the area's mines and oil fields, looking for relief from seasonal allergies that have gotten worse, likely due to a particularly dry winter in the high desert. But not surprisingly, Harvey says she has a cure.
Equal parts of lemon, lavender, and peppermint. You can take it in a capsule. You can shoot it back with like whiskey, not with, but like whiskey, if you're brave enough to do that. And just as an instance, I used it on my children last summer, if everybody remembers how the air quality here was so smoke-filled. They'd ride their bikes till it was dark, come in with itchy, watery, runny nose, watery eyes, and I applied that solution to their backs of their spines. Within 15, 20 minutes, the symptoms were totally gone.
Harvey doesn't see Wild Roots as only a retail store. She sees it as a learning center for the community to explore alternative therapies. That's why almost once a week, she lets local, longtime alternative medicine devotees lead free classes in aromatherapy, reflexology, and of course, her personal passion, essential oils.
As I mentioned before, our essential oils are very, very powerful. And for example, if you want to use oregano in cooking, you put in a toothpick into the oregano, and then you put the toothpick in, say, the spaghetti sauce, because it's very strong.
Harvey warns that using essential oils shouldn't be done passively. She says the key to having a positive experience is knowledge of how these oils affect our bodies.
There are different grades of essential oils available. Doing your research is key. That's why we offer the free classes. It's very easy to have a bad experience without the proper research and know how to do it. That's what I'm here for.
Harvey says what was once only a desire to see her family healthy and happy has now become a full-on mission to help her community find a better way to heal, one that's perhaps more natural for our bodies and our environment. And she hopes that Wild Roots will be the epicenter of that change. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Amanda LeClaire in Rock Springs.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow all of us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.